This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room. You're listening.
Hey, it's 6 o'clock and time again for Brain Matters, the official radio show of the UA Counseling Center. We are broadcasting live from the WVUA FM studio, 90.7, the Capstone, on the campus of the University of Alabama. Good evening. My name is Dr. BJ Gunther, and I'm the host of the show. And in case you don't know, this show is about mental and physical health issues that affect college students, and in particular, UA students. And you can listen to us live each Tuesday night at 6 p.m. on 90.7 FM, or you can go online and listen at wvuafm.ua.edu, or you can also download the Crimson White app and click on the 90.7 live streaming link. As always, we will be taking questions via email. So if you're listening and you have some questions for myself or my guest, you can email those questions to brainmattersradio@wvuafm.ua.edu. Also, if you have any show ideas for upcoming dates for the rest of this semester. I think we've got most of the shows planned out for the rest of this semester, but we definitely need some new show ideas for the spring semester. You can email those. Again, the email address is brainmattersradio@wvuafm.ua.edu. And of course, I'll always consider using your show topic idea. The topic of tonight's show is an interesting one. I have several students I'm working with right now who have been diagnosed with OCD, which stands for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. And I'm titling the show tonight, Navigating College with OCD. You know, in some ways, OCD is like other health conditions such as asthma, allergies, or diabetes. And when properly treated, these chronic conditions are manageable and are actually managed by millions of people around you. Like these other conditions, OCD requires a commitment to treatment. While there is currently no cure for OCD, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, can help you better and teach you how to keep your OCD under control. My guest tonight is joining us by phone, and I'm so happy to have her on the air with us tonight. She's going to talk a lot about, hopefully, her experiences and share some of her ideas about OCD. Sarah Vandershoff, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Sarah, is a journalist and playwright. Her work has appeared in numerous national outlets, including the New York Times, Motherlode Blog, Yahoo News, and the Huffington Post. She's written about mental health for the Washington Post, including pieces on the shortage of child and adolescent psychiatrists, a profile of a young man with severe OCD, and reviews of books on the adolescent brain and depression. Her personal essay about living with OCD appeared in the Washington Post health section and gained widespread attention, prompting her to speak publicly to groups and organizations including NAMI and Vibrant Health in New York, where she hosted several Facebook Live talks with the director of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Sarah earned her BS from Northwestern University and her MFA from the University of Alabama's Professional Actor Training Program, housed at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. She lives in New Jersey with her husband and two daughters, and she's currently writing her second play. Sarah, can you hear me?
Thank you.
Hey!
Introduction.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was a lot to read, and I was so excited to get your email when you agreed to be on the show because, you know, I actually was researching about OCD because I knew I wanted to have a show on OCD, and I came across some of the writings that you talked about. I think some of the writings about the young man with severe OCD, and I just, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to shoot her an email and see if she'll respond to me, and then I found out you do actually have a degree from the University of Alabama, so that was ironic.
Isn't it? I know, and it's a wonderful coincidence, so thank you for inviting me.
Well, tell us a little bit, you know, I've read some of your credentials on the air just in your introduction. But tell us a little bit about why you are so interested in mental health issues and OCD.
Oh, sure. There are a few reasons. One of them, certainly in terms of writing about OCD, I'll be honest with you, when I sat with my therapist and she suggested that I write about the experience, the first time she said that, I had just a feeling of dread and fear, and I wasn't ready to really investigate that story of myself. And then I came to a point a few months later where I was ready. And it's so interesting, the power of fear, because I think that epitomizes what the private pain that people with anxiety or OCD are living with, which is that, you know, it's like this invisible monster and you're afraid to face it. And so for me with OCD, when I came to the point through, first of all, recognizing that there was something going on that didn't have to be my only way of thinking. And so for you, when you mentioned you have some students who've recently been diagnosed, I mean, I feel like that's such a gift. Because now they know what they're dealing with. And I think I spent many years thinking it was just the way life was and the way my brain was. And I didn't know there was something else going on. So in any case, when I got to the point where I could face it and write it, I saw that as a sign that I had reached a new point and that if I could help anyone else maybe relieve a little of their own private suffering, realize that they could find a strategy, that was something I could do as a writer. That was, I wanted to do it, and I was no longer afraid to. And then mental health as a topic has fascinated me because, you know, I think it's almost, what is the statistic that 1 in 4 people has a mental health challenge, which means that in any family of 4, there's usually somebody. But I have to say that it's just a human condition. I don't know how anyone goes through a full life without at one point facing depression or anxiety. Or if you have trauma, then panic. You know, I think it's the nature of being human that we are vulnerable or susceptible to these things. And I admire someone who can go through unscathed, but I suspect it's probably more common than not.
Well, and ironically, in doing the research for the show, I watched a few TED Talks, and one of the TED Talks I found was titled My Hidden Diagnosis of OCD. And she, I don't know how old she was, she looked to be maybe in her late 20s, maybe early 30s, and she talked about for years, you know, hiding her compulsive behaviors. And, you know, some of the students who I'm working with now, they're almost, even me as a therapist, they're almost embarrassed to talk about their compulsive behaviors because they know that it sounds strange sometimes because it's different. I mean, it's, you know, there are more common behaviors, you know, like germophobes and, you know, counting. But there's other stranger, I guess you could say, behaviors. And people are, some people are really embarrassed to share that because they know how it sounds. But, you know, even me as a therapist, I've heard a lot. So I try to make them feel a little more comfortable when they're sharing that if they feel like it.
Yes, and it's interesting you say that because I think it's so important for, you know, a patient or someone going to see the therapist that they know that that's a safe space and that in so many ways just articulating and sharing it with someone. And when you realize that they are kind and that they hear you and they're not judging you.
That's right.
That's a relief.
Mm-hmm.
Huge relief. So I hear what you're saying, and I second that in the sense that if there are young people or of any age who are sort of living with their own private fears and pain and afraid to confide in a therapist, then it is something to be encouraged. And I'm sure you've heard a wide variety of things. And I've had people send me private messages, strangers and so forth, and share a lot of things, and there's no shame in that, in having those thoughts. They're intrusive thoughts. That's the nature of OCD.
That's right. That's right. Can you share what are some of the characteristics of OCD? I can sit here and give the definition, and I will if I need to, but what are some of the characteristics?
Well, I've always thought it interesting that it used to be called the doubting disease.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure you know more than I do about that origin. But for me, that's really what epitomizes it, that you have this tremendous sense of doubt. And then that doubt can go in a variety of directions. So for me, I doubted that I was healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a series of these, you know, catastrophic fears that would make me check my skin, you know, thinking, oh, I have skin cancer, and then wanting to get that checked by a dermatologist, and then that would get checked, and then I would doubt that the dermatologist had effectively, you know, yeah, missed one, and then I'd, you know, make another appointment. So that became a circle. But the doubting could be about a variety of things, like, you know, germs are getting sick, or, you know, this fear that a bad thing could happen.
Yeah.
And or that, you know, I know that some people have it manifests where they think they might have hurt someone.
Oh, yes.
They repeat in their head, sort of cycling through, like, did I run someone over and not know it? Or did I, mm-hmm, could I hurt my child? Like, the very worst thing in the world that you could do, they fear that they may do it.
And yeah.
Without their own, in a sense, rationality.
And, well, sometimes it's intrusive thoughts. You know, you mentioned fear of hurting someone. Some of the people I have seen in the past have had intrusive thoughts where they've never done anything and they're never going to do anything, but it's the thought that, and the person I was watching on the TED Talk, she mentioned that. She said she used to have, like, when she would call someone and leave a voicemail message, it would be a normal voicemail message, but then when she would hang up, she, like you said, she would doubt that she had left the message, and instead she kept thinking, oh my goodness, did I tell them that I wanted to, like, you know, run over their cat with a car, or it was something terrible, you know. And she said I would spend 4 hours a day worrying and having anxiety and being fearful about what she'd, you know, what she may or may not have said. Mm-hmm.
I think the young man I interviewed worried that he, for a while, he worried that he could have a fever, so he would have a thermometer and check. This is where the compulsion then would come in, and
yeah,
he would check his temperature, and this was in high school, and he would carry a thermometer with him, and he knew that it was perhaps not logical, and that he would hide.
Exactly.
Checking his temperature, but that was something he needed to do to convince and confirm that he was not sick, that he didn't have a temperature.
Mm-hmm. One of the articles I read was titled "Compulsions Don't Work," and the first sentence starts out, "Research shows that performing compulsions actually makes obsessions come back stronger. Even though it gives you temporary relief, you know, in the long run, they actually reinforce the obsessive thoughts." And I guess that's true, because it is temporary relief, but it's just a vicious cycle.
Yes, it is. I think that touches upon some of the cognitive behavioral therapy strategies that end up helping.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so straightforward as it sounds, but when you get to the point where you recognize your desire for the compulsion, and you know that it is a temptation that down a rabbit hole.
Exactly.
And you learn to just say, you know, even though I don't want to do this, even though my OCD is telling me that I'll feel better if I do,
mm-hmm,
I'm going to choose not to. I'm going to sit with it for a little while, and I'm going to see if this passes. And so for me, for example, I might notice that if you know, what's interesting is the anxiety could be creeping forth from a variety of factors. It's not directly related to my health, but that's where I channel it.
Sure.
And so then if I'm at that point and I want to check my skin or make that extra appointment, I just know now that that's not the path that will lead to actual health,
mm-hmm,
progress.
And mm-hmm,
so I have learned to just, it's almost like you just say, time out.
Yeah.
Let's not go there right now. Put a timeout on it. Don't do that compulsion. I'm fortunate that I have a big support system so that I've gotten to this place. But it speaks to your point, which is that sort of giving in to the compulsion will actually take you down the path that it will be very difficult to then come back.
Well, and does it help when you actually begin to work on the compulsions and the behaviors, does it help when you get some, when you feel like you are making some progress? Or let's say you talk to yourself, you know, like you just mentioned, and tell yourself, okay, I'm not going to do this time. And then the anxiety subsides after a while, or it, maybe it never gets worse. Does that help reinforce that, hey, this is working?
It sure does. And maybe that's what they talk about when they talk about rewiring the
brain. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you do realize that you have this amazing power to almost change those pathways, change the pattern. And one of the biggest gifts I was given was the ability to take very small steps in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
So that I could sense what you're saying, which is this sense of accomplishment or progress, or that the world didn't fall apart.
Exactly.
The anxiety subsided. But I didn't have to do a big step at first. It might have just been, for example, for me, wearing a regular bathing suit to the pool,
mm-hmm.
exposed my skin to the sun, which was kind of a trigger for me. Okay, I only had to do that for 5 minutes at first. And
yeah.
Then I could, you know, put on a cover-up or something.
Sure.
But eventually, now I can go to the pool and sit there for an hour like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I didn't have to do the hour the very first time. I built up that muscle, and then I would go back to the therapist and talk about how it felt for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Slowly, I had a strategy, and eventually, you know, learned to sit with the initial anxiety and know that it passed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yes, that sense of accomplishment.
How old were you when you were diagnosed?
That's a good question, because I was looking at your, you know, the questions before we started.
Right.
I actually was in my late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
That the typical age it says for onset is between 9 and 10, or late adolescence, early adulthood.
Right.
And I suspect that I, in around 9 years old, I exhibited signs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I probably coasted for a while, and then it bubbled up again my sophomore year in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I tucked it away enough. And it wasn't until I was in my later 30s, and my husband said that he could no longer be my sort of the sounding board.
Yes.
For my doubt.
Yes.
That he didn't want to be in the role of having to, you know, listen to the anxieties and in a sense, you could say soothe them, but in fact, it's just a cycle of exacerbation. And then he didn't want our children to grow up in a home in which the anxiety was an overriding factor.
And exactly, yes.
Really, that was my wake-up call. If he hadn't said that, I don't know if I would have so directly sought out very specific help.
Mm-hmm.
He really said, it's time to make progress.
Almost like an ultimatum, you know?
Pardon me?
It was almost like an ultimatum. Like, you've got to do something or else, you know? Uh-huh.
And it was a gift. Now, the other thing is, we have the kind of relationship where he very rarely asked me to do something. So when he did, I had to hear it.
Yeah.
And that's probably a wonderful thing, which was that, wow, if it means so much that this is affecting him and he's so tolerant and patient, then I really need to look at this and figure out how to make some progress. And that's where I think your work with students in their, you know, late teens, 20s,
mm-hmm.
Undergrads, what a gift if they have the skills to manage their OCD.
And oh, life. Yes.
They have decades to reap the benefits.
Well, and a lot of the research that I've read and studied, you know, talks about OCD tends to surface for the first time in college. And other people, you know, have their first symptoms while they're away at school. What do you think it is about college that triggers people sometimes? Because I think sometimes, like you said, maybe children have OCD tendencies, but they're able to compensate somehow. And people don't necessarily, either they hide it very well, or people just think, oh, they're just being a kid. They don't pick that up. but then it becomes an issue most of the time if it's going to, if you're predisposed to having OCD, that's when it will surface in college. Why do you think that is?
Well, that's a great question. I wonder if there may be multiple things coming together to make it a perfect storm. You know how they talk about the adolescent brain is still developing until age 26 or so.
Mm-hmm.
You have to imagine, I assume, that there's just some hormonal chemical changes that are still happening and evolving during that period.
Yes.
That are, beyond our control. And then there are the factors of being away from home and the system of the pattern and security that you've had for most of your upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the new environment and, in a sense, having to make new friends and figure out who you are as a student, maybe facing some setbacks as a student for the first time if you've always had a certain expectation through your, earlier years in high school. And then not having the structure of nobody's following up with, are you getting enough sleep? Are you having breakfast? Are you, how are you? No, there's no one else.
Right.
So it could feel like a free fall. And then there could be the anxiety, which I don't know how you feel, but it seems like underneath OCD is severe anxiety.
Oh, yes.
Which may or may not be related to the way in which OCD manifests
mm-hmm.
in terms of the obsessions and compulsions.
I agree.
It could be completely related to something else, or the trigger could be very different. The other interesting thing is, personally, and I talked to the gentleman that I did the profile on also, his OCD comes in seasons.
Hmm.
And for him, it was November.
Wow.
And I don't know what about November.
I don't know if I've ever heard of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It is interesting because I often have my most, my free fall moments where I feel like, what's
here it comes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. In September and October. And it's always been that way.
Hmm.
And you could say, is it because of the start of the school year? My therapist also just suggested it's the change of season.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Mood disorders can be affected by that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. But I notice it, and what's comforting, or not comforting, but rather just helpful, is when you have some patterns like that, then it's not such a surprise, and you almost can sit with it again and just say, okay.
Here it comes again. I always get like this every year, yeah.
Yeah, and so what can I do? Maybe, I don't know what strategies you use with your students, but, if they know that they're in a more vulnerable period, then,
mm-hmm.
Those are the times to make sure you keep your appointments with your therapist or do the yoga or get enough sleep and all the little things that add up to giving you more protection.
That's right. Hey, listen, Sarah.
The idea of what it is about college, I do think it is a test of being a young adult for one of the first times, and there are tremendous pressures that come with that.
Oh, yeah, and a huge transition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. If you will stay on the line, then when you come back, let's talk a little bit about factors that trigger OCD and also what are the causes. Is it inherited? So stay on the line. You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone.
This is Mary Alice with the High Divers, and you're listening to WVU.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show host or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
Hey, you're back listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. I'm Dr. BJ Gunther. My guest tonight is Sarah Vandershoff. Did I pronounce your last name correctly, Sarah? I never asked you that.
Oh, no, you're great. It's Vandershaff.
Oh, sorry.
You're so close, I can't even argue with it.
I'll just say Sarah. And Sarah's written many publications. She's a journalist and a playwright. And her public, some of the reason I became interested is and got in touch with Sarah is because of so many of the articles that I've started finding where she had published some information about her research and interviews with people or her own experience with OCD. And that's what we're talking about tonight. And when we left to take the break, you mentioned seasons of OCD, like maybe people have certain patterns or certain times of the year where it gets worse. I find that some people actually, I don't know how to say this. I've had some students who actually major in careers that it seems like it would worsen their OCD symptoms. Now, could you guess what majors would be maybe the worst?
Pre-med, perhaps?
Perhaps. Nursing, mm-hmm. You know. Definitely nursing, something where you have to be, if you have a thing with germs and then you major in nursing, wouldn't you think that would make it worse?
Mm-hmm.
I know.
I wonder if it shows their, I was talking to someone else about this too, their sense of persistence.
But yes.
They know that they can move past the OCD, or they strongly desire to.
Mm-hmm.
So they're almost challenging themselves.
That's right.
By choosing a vocation that is so constantly.
It's like constant exposure therapy.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
But it can also cause tremendous anxiety, too, if the person is not working with a therapist or it's so severe. Or, you know, they're not taking any kind of medication either. I mean, most of the articles I read and most of the people I've worked with, they are most successful taking medication along with talk therapy. That's what works. And, you know, I'm thinking about the students I'm working with now. They do take medication, but they also are very good at coming to therapy regularly. And practicing what we talk about in our sessions. So that.
Yes. And when you say talk therapy, do you mean specifically the behavioral?
Yes. Yes.
Cognitive behavior.
Exactly.
Therapy, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, okay, back to my question about you. Do you think OCD, is it inherited? Did anybody else in your family have severe anxiety or even OCD?
Question, and I remember, you know, when you do the first session with your psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
And they ask you for a family history, and I started going through it. I was like, well,
wow.
No, why wouldn't I be here? and yet, I don't know if family connects the dots. You know, it's really, I feel like, and I was talking to someone else about this, about medical history.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a generation ago, you know, cancer was something people didn't talk about.
Right.
So, you know, you have a whole generation of people waking up to discover that their grandmother or great-grandmother, you know, oh, they had XYZ cancer. Why didn't I know that?
Yeah.
I think with mental illness, the stigma, which, 50 years ago without the same medications, or go back even further and institutionalization and the shame carried with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a sad legacy, but we might not know much about some of our family history.
Right.
Looking at my more immediate family history, I think it's clear there's anxiety in the family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of anyone else who's used the word OCD, and it wasn't something that was even mentioned as a possibility when I was, until I went as a, you know, adult, as a 30-something-year-old, which is, I don't know how uncommon that is. I have friends now, though, who say to me, because they confide, they have anxiety or OCD, and they ask, what are you going to do with your kids, you know? Are you going to... When are you going to talk to them about it?
Hmm.
Do you talk to them about it?
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be curious to know if, you know, your students who are in their early 20s now, if they come already knowing their family history better. My understanding is it's a combination of nature and nurture.
Yeah.
And I think they feed on each other.
Right, so, right. Yeah. Many of my students, the ones I'm working with currently, they, you know, like you said, many of them, they'll either say, I don't know, and they don't talk about it in their family, or either their family doesn't even know they're coming to counseling. Or they might say, I think my mom has anxiety, but she's not being treated for it and doesn't take medication. Very rarely do I hear somebody say, yes, my mother and my sister both are diagnosed with OCD and are treated. So, wow. Yeah.
It's hard then, I think, when you're in an environment as a child,
mm-hmm.
to know what is a typical amount of anxiety and what is something that could be handled in a different way, because you don't have any perspective on an alternative.
If yeah.
you're being, you know, if you're raised in an environment in which anxiety is successful.
Well, another thing, let me ask you if you've heard of this. I'm sure you have doing your research, but I discovered, and I didn't know this existed on social media, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to, that there is a hashtag OCD. And you can actually hashtag OCD and see people's near-perfect organizations of, like, their closets or their pantries. It's almost like it feeds into somebody who has OCD. It almost, you know, feeds into that. But I could not believe that. Well, I guess I could believe that, but I had no idea that anything like that existed. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, I've heard about the debate about it.
Mm-hmm.
That using the hashtag, or just even using OCD as a catchphrase,
yeah.
mean sort of very organized or extremely concerned that things are in perfect order.
Right.
And the debate about does it demean the severity of true OCD?
Mm-hmm.
Does it capture, a reality of some OCD? Where does it fall in the realm of appreciating the pain of this disease? And where is it simply a cute phrase to mean that you're well organized?
Right.
And
that's
I don't
right.
think we can police social media enough to know if there's a consistent answer.
No.
I don't know how, I think the severity of some forms of OCD is so great that it must be very painful for people to think that culture and society at large thinks of it as a cute little fixation
yeah,
order.
Yeah, definitely.
You know?
That's right. That's right. Because a lot of people use that term just loosely, you know, for I'm so OCD, you know, whatever it is. And they don't understand. No, there's really people who struggle with this minute by minute sometimes. I mean, my first experience when I was in graduate school, I had no idea really what OCD was. I probably had heard about it, but I didn't study it. And I had a friend in graduate school who I studied with, and I went to her house and picked her up one night. And it took us like 15 minutes to leave the house because she kept going back to the front door, checking the front door. And at that point, it hit me. I was like, there is something wrong here. I don't understand but I didn't say anything to her, of course. But that was my first experience really knowing somebody who I could tell she was struggling. And I don't even know if she ever got diagnosed or was diagnosed, but she had the checking, you know, compulsion.
What's interesting you say that, because I was every Tuesday night I would go to the same waiting room while
yeah.
my daughter did dance class. And
mm-hmm.
I remember there was a mother there with her daughter
mm-hmm.
who wasn't in dance. You know, they were waiting while the older sister did it. And I would just casually see through the corner of my eye the mother make her daughter go wash her hands
oh.
and then come back to the table
oh.
and then make her sharpen a pencil. And then admonish her for something, and then maybe make her wash her hands again. And,
wow.
And what I was observing was clearly a great deal of anxiety on
mm-hmm.
the part of mothers. And I just, my heart went out to the child.
I know.
But just as you did, I didn't know how to respond.
Exactly.
Even my friends. And I don't know if they're, how people who are seeing someone else struggling are, you know, supposed to
address that or even speak up, you know.
I said to her, I recognize some of what you're doing because I feel, you know, great anxiety myself.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, and I sometimes regret not saying something, mostly because of the children.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you don't want to, sometimes people don't even realize they don't know what they're doing, and you don't want to embarrass them, you know, by pointing it out. You know, you mentioned the sophomore year in college for you is when it popped up again. How did it affect you in college?
I'm sorry, I missed part of that. How did it affect me?
Yes, you said in sophomore during your sophomore year it popped up again. And I wanted to know how did OCD affect you while you were in college?
Right. Well, first of all, I didn't know what it was,
mm-hmm.
which I think is one of the reasons why I'm happy that you have this program and that you're doing this particular episode.
Because, yeah.
If people in college actually know what's going on, they can be equipped with so many better skills. I guess for me, I saw my mentor from high school die of AIDS,
mm-hmm.
and that I think set up
triggered it
a great amount of anxiety,
mm-hmm.
Related to health, and then a peer who I was not close with shortly after died also, which brought the whole. The whole devastating disease very close to home in some way, and I internalized the anxiety by limiting a lot of my choices.
Mm-hmm.
I think I lost the ability to do some of the creative things that I had previously been able to do.
Yeah.
For me, that related to my major, which was acting, and I lost the ability to focus. But I was still able to keep up my grades and sort of persevere and plow through things.
Mm-hmm.
But it caught up to me, but I was definitely subverting it, and it affected relationships.
Sure.
I didn't trust myself or see myself capable of being in a real relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a lost opportunity when you're in college. So I guess I think I tried to protect myself. I didn't have as much clear-cut intrusive thoughts and rituals, you could say.
Exactly.
But I had a tremendous amount of anxiety at that time.
Do you think it's, you know, I mentioned hiding symptoms. Do you think that it is even possible to hide symptoms?
I do.
Really?
Oh, I also think it's possible to keep your symptoms extremely private in some of the people I've interviewed. You know how sometimes young people will make bargains where they want to throw, like,
mm-hmm.
let's say, a crumpled up piece of paper into a trash can.
Oh, yeah.
If they
it's like a game.
Basket,
mm-hmm.
Then XYZ happens. And if they miss, then, you know, there'll be an earthquake.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yes, like they'll completely convince themselves they have the power through doing this ritual to control various things.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do that with the door closed, you know, or need to touch things or eat a certain way.
Or wash your hands, you know, not necessarily anybody's really going to know that necessarily.
No,
mm-hmm.
The bargains that you can make quietly,
mm-hmm.
and you're negotiating with yourself, and nobody may know. But I think it takes a toll whether the person doing those rituals knows it or not. You know, you are, that much energy is being spent on that and not engaging with your loved ones or engaging in what's in front of you.
Right.
Finding joy in life. You know, there is a cost to them, even if they're private.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got to ask you this. Have you ever, let me see if I can ask this the right way. Have you ever had to complete a behavior or a ritual and it cost you? In other words, like it made you late for something or you missed out on something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So mine were a little different.
Mm-hmm.
I think it made me... So the short answer is no, I've never missed, the bus or missed...
Exactly, yeah.
...a concert or not been able to leave the house. But I have missed other opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know I had...
Go ahead. I'm just thinking because I've interviewed people, I think, for whom it would be more true that they literally, not been able to leave work.
Yes.
Say. So they missed getting home to be with their family because they were worried about a task that they thought they needed to complete.
Sometimes I'll have students who come in, and I don't know if they actually exhibit other behaviors, but this one sticks out. They can't complete like a paper because they're perfectionistic. So it's never perfect.
Yeah.
And I felt like that has some OCD traits to me. You know, something feels OCD-ish, is what I say, about that. But I can remember a couple of graduate students that were facing, is, I don't know if it was self-sabotage or actual OCD stuff, but it really sounded like that.
Yes, that reminds me, I interviewed a young man who was from China, but he had come to the United States to go to boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
He is extremely intelligent, obviously, and very motivated. And then OCD really set him back. And one thing he mentioned was that, I think it might have been earlier, studying for the SAT,
Ooh. He
couldn't bring himself to open the book.
There you go.
Because he was so worried he would contaminate it.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it was, in a sense, what it was really about was his fear of not doing well.
Mm.
And he, in a sense, pushed that into the fear of the germs and contaminating the actual book.
Wow.
And I think that's an interesting example because, as an outside observer, you could really be puzzled and you could think, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Are you not motivated or this or that? And you could see a parent misunderstanding that behavior. And it's so much more complicated because of what it's connected to.
So much more. One of the articles, it said OCD is a disease that demands perfection. And it's true.
Well, that's interesting because in my case, I wanted to know with absolute certainty that I was healthy.
Yes.
And none of us knows with absolute certainty.
That's right.
So what you're saying about perfection, a lot of my cognitive behavior therapy is also, in some ways, just more about opening up this idea that we are always in a constant state of unknowing, and that applies to our health and so forth. And so there's no perfection in that.
Mm-hmm.
And being okay with that uncertainty.
Well, do you think, what about like disorders that coexist with OCD? Do you think those go along with it, such as depression? Did you experience any of that? Of course, we've already talked a little bit about anxiety, but some of the other comorbid disorders that I read in some of the research articles, and in particular, depression.
Great point. And I think there's two things there. One of the things my own psychiatrist talked about was that in a lifespan, you could have a phase of depression, you could go through anxiety. Mental illness doesn't have clear boundaries all the time.
And right.
The name of the diagnosis is probably less important than treating the symptoms at times.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say there was probably an episode in my 20s where technically I was had a period of depression.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my experience has probably been more akin to anxiety.
Yeah.
I used to have panic attacks, and that's probably one of the most wonderful parts about addressing the OCD was that going along with that, I was able to look at the panic.
Yeah.
And I think that, on the one hand, having comorbid conditions is more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
With mental health, many of the strategies can be extrapolated and applied to other things. For example, I reviewed a book, which could be of interest to your listeners, called The Antidepressant Book, written by a psychiatrist out at Stanford, Jacob Powery, and he made also an audio version to listen to. And many of his strategies, which were very practical strategies for addressing depression, really had parallels in addressing anxiety also. So I thought that was actually fabulous because, in a sense, depending on what you're dealing with or when one is stronger than the other, a lot of those practical, some of it was behavioral and some of it was cognitive, but I thought they worked for both.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking, I had a couple of more questions for you. Name the title of that book again, the antidepressant book, and who was it by?
Sure, it's by Jacob Powery. I think it's Powery.
Okay.
What's nice is that he decided he needed to do an audio version because he realized some of his clients, he's a child and adolescent psychiatrist, they either didn't like to read, they were too busy to read. some, it was just a cumbersome. And he narrates it. He's really great. It's nice to have his voice, in a sense. He's the one telling you his strategies. And, and so, yeah, I'm just double-checking. Jacob Towery.
Towery. T-O-W-R-E-Y. Yeah,
antidepressant book. There
okay,
it is.
Perfect. Yeah. Do you... Do you know of anyone, in doing your research, have you ever met anyone who only had the obsessions but didn't do the compulsive behaviors?
Oh, no. And I've seen that on social media also, the pure O.
Yes, the pure O. You're right. And I did not realize that that was what it was called until I was doing my research for this. and I had one client years ago. And he was young. He was probably in his 20s. And his was so severe, he was going for a consult appointment for surgery, for brain surgery. And I believe it was at Johns Hopkins University Medical. And I never really saw him again. Sometimes you just see people once or twice and you don't see him again. But I always wondered, you know, what happened, because he really didn't have the compulsive behaviors, but he had the obsessions.
No, I've not, and I wonder if in some ways people with that are able, I don't know, if maybe it's more private in some ways.
Maybe.
You know, there's a wonderful organization, I don't know if you're familiar with it, called the International OCD Foundation.
Okay.
And they have a pretty good website, iocdf.org. And what's interesting about them is they started, I guess back in the 80s when they were doing the first clinical drug trials for people with OCD, and I don't remember which drug it was, but it was an antidepressant. The doctor who was monitoring the drug trial thought it would be helpful to get the group of patients together also, and they formed, in a sense, a group therapy.
Wow.
And then out of that grew this foundation, and it's one of the best resources on OCD out there. And they also... I mean, they have a variety of topics, and they have, a yearly conference for anyone from, you know, people who experience OCD to caregivers to experts. They're just a leading organization.
Yeah.
It's just nice to know about if people are interested.
International OCD Foundation.
OCD Foundation.
That's a wonderful resource. Yeah, and I'm going to mention that to my students. Yeah. Because I'm not sure they are aware of that. One of the students I'm working with, actually, she's been in treatment. It was more of an intensive outpatient treatment. It wasn't inpatient. So she may know more about the resources than most people who I've worked with. Okay, last question, Sarah, and then I'll let you go because I know you're on Eastern time, so it's a little bit later. What helped you the most?
That's a great question. I'm happy to talk about it because what helps me the most is keeping the framework that keeps me moving forward, I guess you could say. So like you said in the very beginning of the show, there's not a cure, but there's a way to manage it. And so I have tried to say, well, maybe I don't need the antidepressant. Maybe I know all that I need to know now. And inevitably, it's, as they say, it's the life preserver. When I follow that meditation, then I can go to yoga, and I'm very good about the continuing to put myself in situations that used to trigger the anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's going to the pool in a regular bathing suit. That sounds so silly, but, you know, that's what keeps me from regressing.
Yeah.
So I go see my therapist. I go see my psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
I take my medicine. I recognize when...
when you're having, a bad month.
I recognize that. I back off on things if I think that the anxiety is upticking and it's going to lead to trouble. That self-care aspect. So
right.
I think the biggest thing after you've found your team of care, you know, people who can provide care, is sticking with your plan. Just because you feel better, that's absolutely not the time to let go of the
plan. I know. Yes. Yes. You are so right. Hey, before I let you go, really quick, what projects are you working on? I know in the intro I mentioned you're writing your second play, but can you tell us a little bit about that or some upcoming speaking engagements or articles that are going to be released, any projects you've got going right now?
Oh, thanks for the question.
Sure.
Yeah, no, I'm working on my second play, which it's a little complicated, but fingers crossed.
Yeah.
It's an adaptation of a book that looks at the end of World War II. And then I'm working on a story right now that actually looks at the generation that we're raising, for the post-millennial generation, which
will
actually be the young people, you know, who are first years at the University of Alabama.
That's right.
Now.
That's right.
Yeah. So looking at their worldview, they don't really have an official name yet. They're not millennials. What are they?
What are they? Yeah, do tell. Let me in on it first. Wow. That sounds fascinating, and it sounds challenging, too, you know? Who comes up with the names for the generations, you know?
I know.
You could be the first.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much for taking time. I know you're a busy person, and I just appreciate you so much for taking the time out to talk with us here. We're just a Campus Run radio show, and we just try to do something each week that's of interest to our students and our listeners in the community. So I really appreciate it, Sarah. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, BJ. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. Let me make a few announcements before we close the show tonight. Don't forget our shows are recorded and podcasted on the audioboom.com website. Just type in Brain Matters and you'll find some of our past shows. And there's also a link to Audio Boom on the Counseling Center's website. It's at counseling.ua.edu. I need to make an announcement tonight. My production assistant tonight is Lizzie Zeman, and she's involved with this program. It's a very good program. It's about childhood hunger. A serious problem within the United States is childhood hunger, and 1 in 5 children struggles with food insecurity. To help reduce this number, Secret Meals for Hungry Children hosted the Tackle Trivia Tackle Hunger event a couple of weeks ago and wanted to thank those who came out. It was a great benefit that raised money to help pay for nutritional food packs that Secret Meals provides to hungry children on the weekends. 100% of the money raised will go to the children right here in West Alabama, and it only costs $140 to feed one child for an entire school year. If you didn't get the chance to come to the event or donate, there's still a silent auction going on for an autographed Nick Saban football that will end November 3rd, so it'll end this week, it sounds like. And if you don't want to bid, you can still make a donation to Secret Meals. Then the details are on the Tackle Trivia, Tackle Hunger Facebook event page. There's no minimum on how much you can donate, and any donation will help. So thank you in advance for helping out with this great cause. I also want to thank a few people who always make this show possible. Our executive director at the Counseling Center, Dr. Lee Keyes, Terry Siggers from the Office of Student Media. My production assistant tonight is Lizzie Zeman. And also, I want to thank the Counseling Center staff, the WVUA staff, and, of course, my guest tonight, Sarah Vandersheff. And I want to mention our show topic next week. It's going to be an interesting show topic. I don't really know how this is going to pan out, but I hope it'll be interesting. But it's the man effect, defining masculinity. So if you're interested, join us next week. And thanks again for listening tonight to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. Good night.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show host or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.